It's never been an open system. We've never had an opportunity for citizens to express their dissent when the country goes to war. And one of the reasons is that the media, the newspapers, the radio and television stations, have always gone along with administration policy in preparing for war and going to war. So we've never really had an open American system. We've had a system that has been largely closed, with citizens having to create their own apertures with, you know, alternative newspapers, alternative and community radio stations, yes, alternative radio. We've had to have citizens take advantage of the few apertures in the system in order to express their dissent.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn on Can the System Be Fixed? The scale of corporate scandals is unprecedented in American history. Many workers have not only lost their jobs, but also their savings, pensions, and investments. Upper management, the so-called captains of industry, cashed in their stocks long before they tanked. Some big-name Wall Street brokers, racking up commissions, were selling gullible investors' stocks that they were describing in internal memos as crap and junk. WorldCom, the telecom giant, might take the cake for sheer perfidy. When its bubble originally burst, it was revealed that they had cooked their books to the tune of $4 billion. Now there's another three to add on. Responding to public outcry, Congress, with much fanfare and photo ops, passed a corporate reform bill. Consumer advocate Ralph Nader calls it modest. Rogue capitalism has many people asking the question, can the system be fixed? Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University, is perhaps this country's premier radical historian. He grew up in Brooklyn and worked in the shipyards. During World War II, he saw combat duty as an Air Force bombardier. After the war, he went to Columbia University on the GI Bill. He was an active figure in the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements. His masterpiece, A People's History of the United States, continues to sell in huge numbers. He's also written several plays, including Emma and Marx in Soho. His latest book is Terrorism and War. Professor Zinn's been honored with numerous awards, including the Upton Sinclair Award, the Lannan Foundation Award, and the Eugene Debs Award. I spoke with him in the second week of August, 2002. Welcome to the program, Howard Zinn.
Thank you, David.
I want to start with something from F. Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote a novel about the Roaring Twenties called The Great Gatsby and the excesses that characterized that period just before the Great Depression. This Fitzgerald wrote, "They were careless people. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess they had made." I wonder if you could comment on that in the context of the current corporate crime wave.
It's interesting that you should quote F. Scott Fitzgerald, because the 20s have so much in common with what we are seeing these days. And that is, you know, in the 20s we had governments in power that insisted on distributing the wealth of the country in such a way that the rich got richer and the poor stayed where they are or got poorer. And wild speculation took place, and vast fortunes were made while people in the poor districts of the cities were struggling just to pay the rent and get food on the table. And you had capitalism run amok, or what actually the Pope said not long ago in an interview with an Italian newspaper. He talked about savage, unbridled capitalism. And that's what we saw in the 20s. That's what we're seeing today, except, of course, that today it's even more unbridled, more savage, and on a global scale, running amok throughout the world and causing havoc in various places in the world, aside from leaving people in the United States, many of them, you know, in desperation, without medical care, without adequate education, without adequate housing. So we're seeing just what F. Scott Fitzgerald saw in the 20s. You know, we're seeing that today.
Well, why is it that crime in the streets has historically attracted much more attention than, say, what Ralph Nader calls crime in the suites, the white-collar crime?
Well, several reasons, I suppose. One is that the people who define crime are the people who are connected with the crime in the suites. They're the ones who say what crime is. And so if somebody robs a store, holds up somebody in the street, well, of course, that's a crime. If somebody robs the consumers of the country of millions and millions of dollars, or robs workers of years of their lives by the conditions under which they work, that's not crime, that's business. So one of the reasons for the emphasis on street crime is that the people who define the crime are the people who are in charge of the culture. They are in charge of the newspapers, of the educational system, and so you see constant headlines about mayhem being done by ordinary people, but what is being done by the corporate giants doesn't get into the newspapers, you know, until it explodes in a very special kind of odious scandal, you know, as in the present. And I suppose, you know, there are other reasons, you know, why street crime is put on, you know, the top of the list of things to be talked about, you know, and corporate crime is not. Street crime is overt. Corporate crime is secret. It's, of course, very important, therefore, to have some people in society who will point out what is being done secretly. You know, these, in the turn of the century, these were called muckrakers. Lincoln Steffens, Ida Tarbell, exposing the doings of the Standard Oil Company. You know, in the 20s also, there was one congressman, Fiorello LaGuardia, who stood up in Congress and exposed what was happening in the country, the rich getting richer, and the people in his poor district in East Harlem, you know, having trouble just keeping their family alive. And today we have our muckrakers. I mean, Jim Hightower, you know, is one of them. Barbara Ehrenreich, you know, is another. Of course, Ralph Nader has been exposing corporate crime for a long time. So what we, of course, need to do is to seek out the information that these muckrakers of our time are putting before us so that we aren't completely ignorant of what is happening.
Well, to provide even more historical context, how would you compare the current crime wave, say, with the robber baron period of the late 19th century? And maybe you can explain what that was for people who are not familiar with it.
The robber barons, the term actually is the title of a book by Matthew Josephson, remarkable book, probably out of print, but the robber barons were the great corporate executives and moguls of the late 19th century, the Vanderbilts and the Hills and the Harrimans who controlled the railroads, the Carnegies and the Mellons who controlled steel and aluminum, the J.P. Morgans who worked out deals by controlling money and merging companies and making huge profits thereby. And they were the people who manipulated the money market. They were the people who owned the factories in which workers worked for 14 hours a day. And and yes, they were the early counterparts of what we have seen in the 20th century. The CEOs making huge sums of money, you know, and laying off their workers as soon as the first sign of trouble hits, and laying them off without taking care of their problems of health insurance, leaving them in the lurch at, you know, when they're 45 or 50 or 55 or 60, having lost their retirement benefits. You know, these are the robber barons, you know, of today.
And just in terms of scale, it seems that what's going on right now is unparalleled in American history, in terms of so many workers have not only lost their jobs, but as you alluded to, have lost their pensions, their investments, essentially their life savings. I just read that the fastest growing sector entering the job market is over 55, between 55 and 70, essentially people who have retired, who have got to go back to work to support themselves.
Yes, you know what's interesting to me is how the word security is bandied about by the government. That is how, you know, they must fingerprint people and keep tabs on people and pick up people in the middle of the night, who happen to be non-citizens, or even a few who are citizens, and how an enormous amount of our national wealth is being given to the military budget, and it's all in the name of security, while the daily life security of people is being taken away from them. Real security, the security that people need when they get to the age where they want to stop working, or the security that all people need when they need to know that they can be able to deal with their medical problems without incurring enormous bills that they can't pay. I mean, the security of having work when you are able to work and you need work, and there are things to be done in the country, that kind of security, the security that human beings need, the security the children need to grow up in healthy environments, that kind of security is simply put aside while the militarization of the country goes on in the name of that word security.
Well, in your view, is the current crisis of capitalism a systemic problem?
Well, it's systemic in the sense that it is not simply an aberration which we will sort of get over. That is, they may put a few corporate crooks in prison. The stock market may go up again, but the fundamental sickness of the system remains. By the fundamental sickness, I mean that even when the stock market is up, even when the worst excesses of the corporate system, let's say, have been slightly corrected, fundamental problems remain. And the fundamental problem that remains is the maldistribution of wealth, the 1% of the country owning over 40% of the wealth, huge salaries at the top, people struggling below, homeless people, huge numbers of people living in inadequate housing, unable to pay their rent. It's systemic because there is something fundamentally flawed about the economic system in which we live. And I believe what is fundamental about the system in which we live, and which is a systemic problem, is the fact that we live in a capitalist system in which profit is the driving force that decides what is done in society. That is, it seems to me, systemic, fundamental, basic. The profit motive, because what that means is that homes will not be built for poor people because there's no money in it. Teacher salaries will not be doubled as they should be because, you know, there's no money in it. The rivers will not be cleaned up, and the lakes will not be cleaned up, and the ocean will not be cleaned up because there's no profit in that. We're not going to curtail the emissions from automobiles, which are polluting the atmosphere and really destroying the environment for ourselves and our children. That won't be done because that would cut into the profits of the automobile manufacturers. And of course, nuclear weapons are made and Sikorsky helicopters are made because they are profitable. So the incentive of profit, which, you know, people who want to glorify our system talk about as a wonderful thing, the incentive of profit may lead to enormous production so that the gross national product rises and rises. But if you look at what that gross national product consists of, well, it's very gross. What it consists of are things that do not solve the day-to-day needs of people. It consists of machines of war and luxuries for the rich. So when I talk about, or you talk about, David, I'm going to put some of the onus on you for bringing up things like this. I'm sorry. But when we talk about something systemic that is the problem, rather than just a few corporate thieves, I think we're talking about something fundamentally wrong with the capitalist system. And what's interesting is that those countries abroad where our leaders talk very happily about, you know, exporting the free market system, private enterprise, capitalism, exporting it to these countries so that they will prosper, we're seeing more and more that countries abroad are suffering as a result of this so-called free market system, private enterprise, that we have brought to them through our own multinationals or through the international agencies. So it's systemic not only for the United States, but because the United States is so dominant in the economic world, it's systemic for the world at large.
The Italian writer Antonio Gramsci, who died in 1937, he was a resistor to fascism, and his health was broken by years in Mussolini's prisons. He wrote of the crisis then that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. And I'm wondering if you see any coincidence there of the current crisis here domestically and the international crisis as being the kind of morbid symptoms that Gramsci referred to.
Well, I'm afraid so. I'm afraid we're seeing even more morbid symptoms today than Gramsci saw in his time. And, you know, when he talks about the old dying and the new not yet born and the morbid symptoms that we see around, I mean, that's a pretty gloomy picture. And I'd like to think that while the new has not been born and the old system has not yet died, that the old system is beginning to show what's wrong with it in a way that will cause more and more people to rebel against it, and therefore for the new to emerge. I mean, I see, you know, women in Nigeria who shut down, you know, Chevron Texaco oil operation in their protest. I mean, the amazing power of supposedly powerless people. Or I see people in Peru protesting against the effects of the so-called free market system on the poor people of Peru. Or I read about the banana workers in Ecuador going on strike against the banana companies, a kind of reminder of what Gabriel Marquez wrote about, you know, in 100 Years of Solitude. And in Poland, there, you know, you see signs, people begin to recognize in Poland that the lovely capitalist system that was promised to them has turned out to be disastrous for the well-being of the people in Poland. In short, well, you know, Gramsci, you know, was accurately describing what he saw. I'd like to look at it more dynamically and see that while a new system, a new way of life has not yet emerged in the world, I believe that there are people all over the world who are beginning to understand that something fundamental is wrong, that something must be done, and are even beginning, you might say, the seeds of rebellion against the old, and the first signs of the emergence of something new.
Certainly since the protests in Seattle in late November, early December 1999, and the growing awareness of linking U.S. Foreign policy with the economic and environmental well-being of the planet is becoming quite apparent. There's been the World Policy Social Forum meetings in Porto Alegre, Brazil, which has drawn tens of thousands of activists from all over the world. So there are a lot of movements out there, a lot of motions.
Yes, I think, you know, Seattle was the beginning of a whole series of protests. And, you know, it's interesting also to me that when there was a meeting, you know, of the World Economic Forum recently, you know, at the Waldorf Astoria.
In New York,
that's right. At that meeting, not only were there protesters outside, but people inside from various countries other than the United States expressed their indignation that the United States was dominating the economies and the politics, you know, around the world. And when you begin to see dissent at the very top, that is the World Economic Forum itself, inside the Waldorf Astoria, of course they're reflecting in part their recognition that there are people outside protesting, and that number of people protesting may grow and grow, but they're also reflecting the fact that their own countries, whether in Africa or in Latin America or in Europe, beginning to resent what the United States is doing by trying to create a kind of a new imperium in the world in which the United States runs everything.
I started off with F. Scott Fitzgerald talking about the excesses of the 1920s. Let me continue with another piece from Joseph Conrad, Heart of Darkness. He was writing, this is a novel that came out in the early 1900s, and he was writing about the Belgium attack and destruction of the Congo, one of the great crimes in human history. This is what Conrad wrote in his novel. They were conquerors, and for that you want only brute force. They grabbed what they could get for the sake of what was to be got. It was robbery with violence, aggravated murder on a grand scale, aggravated murder on a great scale, and men going at it blind. The conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. I'd like you to comment on Conrad's insight there, that the conquest of the earth is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much.
Hmm. Well, yeah, Conrad, through his literary writings, was telling us the same thing that other people have told us, who described the process, the ugly and violent process by which Western nations conquered parts of the earth in modern times. And he was describing, of course, what was happening in the Congo. That made me think, of course, of Barbara Kingsolver's novel, The Poisonwood Bible, a beautifully written book in which she also deals with the Congo in our time, and also made me think of Adam Hochschild's book about the what the Belgians did in the Congo.
King Leopold's Ghost.
Leopold's Ghost, yeah. Right. And but that's, of course, something that has happened throughout Africa in the 19th and into the 20th century, and still going on today. And it also refers to, you know, what has happened in India, in the Middle East, and to American policy in Latin America. I mean, what could be, you know, uglier and more violent than what the United States over the years, from the turn of the century on for 100 years, has done in Latin America, you know, from, you know, the early dispatch of Marines to Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and the taking over of, you know, Panama, and the domination of Cuba, and then more recently the establishment of dictatorships in Guatemala, and the support of dictators in Latin America, and the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people as a result of what can only be described as, you know, yes, the American imperialism, which is a counterpart of what Joseph Conrad described taking place, you know, in Africa. Maybe an imperialism more concealed than the Belgian imperialism, that is more surrounded by, you know, the rhetoric of kindly imperialism, the kind of rhetoric the British used when they tried to justify their taking over in India. You know, we're helping these people, we're doing things for these people, but in the end, the people there suffered and the people there died as a result of the, in the case of the United States, you know, the United States government doing what the oil interests and the United Fruit interests and the sugar interests and the banking interests and the railroad interests doing what they wanted. I mean, the economic motive in American policy in Latin America is more stark and clear probably than anywhere else, you know, except perhaps, you know, when you consider the motive of control of oil in the Middle East.
You're listening to Howard Zinn. Can the system be fixed? This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling the following toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
But now, when the United States helped put into power Pinochet in Chile, that happened as a direct result of the work of AT&T and Anaconda Copper, and its collaboration with the United States government in overthrowing a democratic government in Chile. And when the United States government overthrew the government of Guatemala in 1954, a direct result of the connection between the United Fruit Company and the Eisenhower administration. So what Conrad describes when he talks about the Belgian marauding in the Congo, you know, it's still going on.
Traditionally, the word imperialism and American could not be mentioned in polite discourse, in history books, in the media, but that seems to be changing. There are a couple of things, for example, to point to this American imperialism coming out of the closet. There's a new book by Max Boot called Savage Wars of Peace, which takes its inspiration from Kipling's White Man's Burden. And there's a cover story in the New York Times Magazine, July 28th, by Michael Ignatieff, who is the Carr Professor of Human Rights Policy and Director of the Carr Center at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. And the piece is called How to Keep Afghanistan from Falling Apart, The Case for Committed American Imperialism. He writes, interestingly and quite blatantly, quote, America's entire war on terror is an exercise in imperialism. And then he adds, imperialism used to be the white man's burden. This gave it a bad reputation. But imperialism doesn't stop being necessary just because it becomes politically incorrect. What do you think about those comments?
Well, Ignatieff, it's ironic that he should be professor of human rights policy, because it does not seem to me that imperialism, and certainly not American imperialism, has anything to do with the advancement of human rights, but rather the opposite. Of course, when he says that the war on terror is an exercise in imperialism, I think he's describing accurately what the so-called war on terrorism is, and that is that the war on terrorism is really an excuse, or using terrorists as an excuse, to advance American power, American military bases, American economic power, in other parts of the world where they have not yet reached. But when he says this is necessary, who is it necessary for? He is trying to suggest that imperialism is now a good thing, and that, as he said, imperialism had a bad name. Now, does imperialism now have a good name? Can we point to wonderful things that have happened to countries in the world as a result of American power and American control and American influence? Can we point to wonderful things that happened in Indonesia when the United States supported the government of Indonesia in a war against the people of East Timor, which resulted in several hundred thousand lives being lost? I mean, imperialism is still as ugly and brutal as it always was, but it seems to be becoming important for sort of intellectual defenders of imperialism to come forth in pages of the New York Times Magazine and other places and try to put a good face on what still is Joseph Conrad's and Rudyard Kipling's Savage Wars of Peace, with the word peace being an ironic one when you're making war.
One of the foot soldiers, as it were, of imperialism was Major General Smedley Butler of the U.S. Marine Corps, who's highly decorated. He won the Congressional Medal of Honor. This is what he said in a book, incidentally, entitled Maverick Marine by Hans Schmidt, Kentucky University Press, 1987. This is what Major General Smedley Butler said. I've spent 33 years, most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. I helped purify Nicaragua. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests. I helped in the rape of a half dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I was rewarded with honors, medals, promotions. I might have given Al Capone a few hints, he says. The best he could do was operate a racket in three city districts. The Marines operated on three continents.
Well, Smedley Butler is one of those great whistleblowers of history, those people who come out of the establishment and turn around and point to what it has done and point to it with authority because they participated in what was done. What he is describing, you know, is something, you know, that should be remembered when people read Michael Ignatieff, who talks about the, you know, how imperialism is now necessary, the support of the new imperialism by people like Ignatieff and other writers, the writers in the New Republic, have been talking about this as a necessary thing for the United States to take charge. And what is missing in their statements is any kind of understanding of the history of American foreign policy, because their assumption is that the United States is going to send its troops around the world and they're going to do good things, that their intentions are benign, and this assumption that the intentions of the United States are benign is something that totally collapses when you marauding in the world. I mean, it's a very long history. Mm-hmm. The history of American expansionism is so long and so odious that if you knew it, you could not possibly talk about kindly motives in American expansion. And only a lack of that history would allow people to believe that American power is going to be used for good. You know, and the history of that expansion, you know, goes back to, you know, to the early 19th and mid-19th century, to the extermination of Indian tribes. It goes back, you know, to the Mexican War. It goes back to the turn of the century, the period in which Smedley Butler was involved. And then comes right up to the present time, right up now to the, you know, support of the armed forces of Colombia and to, well, yes, to the so-called war on terrorism.
Well, the Pakistani-born, London-based writer Tariq Ali says that declarations of American imperialism may not be all that bad. He says, now we know where to kneel.
Well, I suppose you might say it's a good thing that they're coming out and coming out of the closet and saying, yes, we're imperialists. But we're nice imperialists, because then all we need to do is examine some history and we'll see how nice our imperialism has been. And it's not just ancient history. It's not just 19th and early 20th century. No, it's history of American foreign policy since World War II. It's a history of American foreign policy in recent decades, and you know, in our invasion of Panama, in the Gulf War, in our bombing of Yugoslavia, in what we are doing today. And I mean, it's interesting that, you know, we are seeing Saddam Hussein as an evil man, and he is. He's a tyrant and so on. But we have been behaving in the most evil way, in causing enormous privation and death among the people of Iraq, even beyond what Saddam Hussein has done to his own people.
Indeed, you wrote in you wrote an essay in Iraq Under Siege, and you also, along with Noam Chomsky, Ed Herman, Edward Said, Angela Davis, June Jordan, and others, signed a petition saying sanctions are weapons of mass destruction.
Mm.
In what way are they weapons of mass destruction?
Well, sanctions are weapons of mass destruction because their result has been, and this is a testimony of Americans who have gone again and again to Iraq and seen the results of sanctions for themselves. The results have been the lack of water and electricity and medical supplies and medicines and the fundamental things that people need to keep alive, and there is the lack of which has its greatest effect on children, so that several hundred thousand children have died as a result of our sanctions. Now, several hundred thousand children have died as a result of our sanctions. I would consider the sanctions to be weapons of mass destruction. I mean, the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction is so interesting because it's constantly brought forth as the reason both for, you know, the sanctions, ironically, and the reason brought forth for possible invasion of Iraq, when the country in the world that possesses the greatest number of weapons of mass destruction is the United States of America. By far, I mean, talk about Saddam Hussein possibly acquiring one nuclear weapon, and the United States has thousands of nuclear weapons. And we say, well, but Saddam Hussein has used his weapons of mass destruction, and yes, he did. He gassed the Kurds back in the 1980s, and but the United States did not disapprove at that time, and the United States, of course, has used its weapons of mass destruction from Hiroshima and Nagasaki on through Vietnam and the Gulf War itself. The United States has used its weapons of mass destruction with far, far greater toll of human life than any other country in the world. It's really remarkably hypocritical for the United States to talk about the threat of weapons of mass destruction.
A day doesn't pass when there isn't a new war plan leaked about attacking Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Joseph Biden, who's considered a liberal, mm-hmm. Democratic chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, mm-hmm. Recently held hearings on the whole issue of Iraq, and the hearings had some of the usual suspects, like Reagan Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, Nixon, Clinton National Security Advisor Samuel Berger. What was noteworthy was the absence of critics such as Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, Scott Ritter, the outspoken ex-Marine who was a UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Hans von Sponeck, and Dennis Halliday, two Assistant Secretary Generals of the UN who were in charge of the oil for food program in Iraq. Biden didn't see fit to call any of those distinguished people as witnesses.
Well, Congress, the Senate, the House of Representatives have a long history of subservience when it comes to presidential plans for war. And if you look through the history of congressional action, when the president has decided on war, we've never had a situation where Congress has dissented, where Congress has halted what turned out to be sort of an aggressive and ignoble act of war on the part of the United States. Congress has always rushed to support whatever the president has done. So I'm not really surprised that Senator Biden had hearings in which he kept out of the hearings the people who actually have been the closest observers of what is going on in Iraq. And instead, as you brought forth, as you said, the usual suspects, the people who would say what the administration wants it to say. I'm afraid it's not going to be Senate hearings that stop the war plans for Iraq. It's going to take resistance and protest by the American people who will say, you know, why should our young people die, and why should people die in Iraq for the ambitions of the American oil companies and the political ambitions of, you know, American leaders. It will take, I think, protest from the grassroots rather than hearings in the Senate to turn American policy around.
Richard Falk, in the August 19th issue of The Nation, has an article entitled The Rush to War, talking about Iraq. And he poses a series of questions at the conclusion of his essay, and I was wondering if you could comment on them. He asks, he poses this: we must ask why the open American system is so closed in this instance. How can we explain this unsavory rush to judgment when so many lives are at stake? What is now wrong with our system, with the vigilance of our citizenry, that such a course of action can be embarked upon without even evoking criticism in high places, much less mass opposition in the streets? How would you respond to Richard Falk?
Well, you know, you shouldn't really be surprised. It's never been an open system. We've never had an opportunity for citizens to express their dissent when the country goes to war. And one of the reasons is that the media, the newspapers, the radio and television stations, have always gone along with administration policy in preparing for war and going to war. So we've never really had an open American system. We've had a system that has been largely closed, with citizens having to create their own apertures with, you know, alternative newspapers, alternative and community radio stations, yes, alternative radio. We've had to have citizens take advantage of the few apertures in the system in order to express their dissent. And yes, it's disturbing that that we are not seeing a great mass revulsion against the plans for war. But I believe that that the idea of going to war against Iraq is going to become more and more sort of obviously wrong to more and more Americans.
Well, let me ask you this in the remaining minutes we have left.
Yes.
How do you account for the dramatic difference in perspectives on Iraq and, I will add, Israel in, let's say, Europe and other parts of the world compared to the United States? It seems that we're living in a bubble that is self-contained and kind of engaging in a circular conversation, while the rest of the world has radically different perspectives.
Well, you're right.
What accounts for that?
Well, well, I suppose what accounts for that is that the other countries do not see themselves benefiting from American domination of oil and American domination of the Middle East. I understand that European nations have actually made arrangements with Iraq for the you know, control of oil supplies, and that the United States doesn't like that. There's actually competition between Europe and the United States on the matter of the control of oil. So I think that, you know, there are conflicts of interest, differences of interest, and it seems that the press overseas is not as willing to bow down before American governmental policy, and is willing to educate the European public in a way that our media are not willing to do.
I'd like to thank Howard Zinn for joining us, a noted historian, author of the classic book, A People's History of the United States, which I now understand has sold 1 million copies.
That's what my publishers tell me. And I always believe my publishers when they give me good news.
Right. And Professor Zinn's new book is entitled Terrorism and War, and a play about Emma Goldman called Emma will soon be published by South End Press. Thanks very much for joining us, Howard Zinn.
Always good to talk with you, David.
That was